Northfield Arts Guild. Visit our gallery's Arts Festival and take in a performance at our theater featuring a full season of dramas, comedies, and musicals. The Guild's gift shop showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, radio for the imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, radio for the imagination.
Good morning. This is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, radio for the imagination. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the show that celebrates all things creating and stories. So let's get ready to tune our imaginations together. I once found a four-leaf clover in the yard of my great Aunt Bessie's house in International Falls, and I set that lucky clover on a tissue and wrapped it in plastic wrap. And when I got home, I hid it in my copy of the Disney book, The Million Dollar Duck. I thought I was so lucky. I forgot about it, though, after years, and then this kid, Jeff, in the neighborhood, asked to borrow that book, so I handed it over to him. Shortly after giving it to him, I remembered the lucky clover and went to his house to ask him for the book back. There was no four-leaf clover in the book. I asked him about it, and he claimed there never was anything tucked into the pages of the book. I really wish I had that lucky charm. Someone out there has it. I really believe it's out there somewhere. I hope I find it someday, but maybe I'll find another one someday. But you know what I wish for more than that clover is more stories about my great-aunt Bessie. I know so little, but what I do know is that she trapped critters to sell to the fur traders. She lived in rugged rural Minnesota. She told great stories and lived a life that most of us will never experience. I would ask her about what life was like as a female in that world. What were some of her scariest moments? Who were some of the characters she met on the way? How did she feel about trapping animals? How did she cope with that rough and tumble life? I wish I had her stories. And reading stories is one of the ways that I can try to enter that world. I love a good story that reveals a slice of life to us. We get to experience worlds, work, tools, relationships, families, lands, dangers, and lives that we would normally not be privy to witness. And I'm so excited today because today on Art Zany Radio, I am pleased to bring you one of those stories. Today on the show, I'm welcoming author Christopher Johnston to discuss his new novel, Where You Come From Is Gone. It's a family story set in northern Minnesota that explores the bonds, pride, legacy, and life cycles of these hardworking commercial fishermen and mink ranching farmers. These characters cope with the trials of rural life, the dangers at work and play, and the games of politics. This story and their struggles will leave a lasting impression. You can get more details at ChristopherJohnstonBooks.com. And Christopher Johnston has published short fiction travel writing, performed as a storyteller on the Moth main stage, and writes Changing Gears on Substack. He worked for 35 years as an engineer and management consultant, which took him to rural communities with struggling businesses throughout North America and Europe. And he was born and raised in Minnesota, where he grew up around the family fishing and mink ranching business. Welcome to Art Zany Radio, Christopher. It's so exciting to have you here.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here.
I'm so thrilled. This is such a big thing. I want to ask to start off with, first tell us a little bit about yourself, if there's any more you want to add to that introduction about you as a writer or about things in your world. And then let us know, when did that story about your family start percolating for you that might make a great novel?
Sure. First of all, I'm involved in some other activities. I'm actually going to be cycling with some of my friends later today, so I've got the bike in back of my car.
Are you cycling in Northfield?
Yes.
Oh, there's a lot of great places.
Going to do some gravel riding.
Oh yeah.
After we're done, so some of my old teammates are going to be showing up. So I'm looking forward to that.
Exciting.
The novel really started percolating probably in about 2009, 2010. I was in a short story class actually at the Loft, and I wrote a story about these two brothers that meet in a small town bar, and they're discussing essentially what has happened to them. And as I had written this short story, as it comes out, you find, and this isn't giving anything away in the novel, but this is where the story originated. These two brothers meet in a bar, and you eventually learn as they're talking that both of their oldest boys have been killed.
Ooh.
In various accidents and mishaps that they're related to. And they've been estranged because of that, and so that slowly reveals. And the writing instructor basically said, you're trying to do too much in a short story. And at that point, that's where I thought, okay, he said this needs to be a novel and fill in the background and everything. So that's really the original seed of what became the novel.
It was, and on your family business, did you, as you're living that life, and you know, Mink Rancher isn't something that a lot of people really know and understand. Did you think, this is a cool thing that most people don't know? I should write about it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lifestyle and way of life that just really very few people know about, even people who live in Minnesota. It was a really fairly significant industry. Well, both commercial fishing and mink ranching were fairly significant businesses in Minnesota, you know, starting the early 20th century until probably the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lifestyle that existed, but I don't think a lot of people in the state heard about it or were familiar with it, and so I felt it was really something that was a compelling setting for a story.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you and I met, this is where part of the story, I think this is something I haven't had the experience of being, well, I guess I have talked to Kurt from our group as well, and Peter, but we met at the loft in the, it was called the Novel Writing Project.
That's right.
And that was taught by Peter Guy, and we were both in that class working on our, developing our ideas, which <Right. laughs> were, it was a rough, we were at the very early stages of putting it all together, I think.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the things that stand out from that novel writing class at the loft for you?
I guess the main thing was having to have pages done by a certain date. You know, one of the things that, you know, Peter emphasized, and that was, you know, kind of a mantra in the class was, you know, okay, you've got to have, I think it was typically like 50 pages, you know, and we'd usually have what, like, I remember it'd be like 6 weeks or 8 weeks mm-hmm. to get your 50 pages done to be ready for workshop. And I guess this comes from my bicycle racing background, in a sense, is I was not going to be the person who didn't have their pages done. So I wanted to make sure that I had them done, you know, whether they were, you know, good or bad or indifferent. But the thing that I think that I really learned from that process of saying, okay, I've got to have my pages done by a certain date, was really, I think of it almost like a sculptor or something, where you got to have material to work with.
Mm.
So it almost doesn't matter how good it is, that, you know, as they say, the crappy first draft. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to get material that I can work with. So just tell the story, get stuff out there, and then you've got something that you can work with, that you can stretch, modify, and make, you know, make it more artful and, you know, and all of those things.
Yeah, I remember that pressure too, because it was, I had a mess of things and not everything was connected and there wasn't really a through line. I have no idea what was, you know, it was just, I just wrote these little ditties, right, if you will, and to try to shape them into a bigger piece. Undertaking the writing of a novel is something that is much harder than I think anyone ever imagines.
Yeah, no, I agree. And another thing that I guess I mentioned earlier, that I was an elite level racing cyclist. The one thing that my cycling coach always told me was, you know, just move the mountain a spoonful at a time. And in mm-hmm. terms of training, you know, you're not going to go from zero to great right away. So I also thought about that in terms of the writing the novel as well. It's just like, okay, I just need to write any given day, you know, do 500 words, do 1,000 words, maybe 1,500, and mm-hmm. then just try to do that, get something out, and just keep doing that day after day after day, and eventually you end up with a massive material, and then from that massive material, then you can start you know, doing revision and editing and polishing and all of that. Give yourself something to work with.
Yeah, and that's I can be witness to that for you, because I saw some of those earlier drafts, and then to read the completed published novel is very exciting. Mm-hmm. It's really mm-hmm. wonderful. Yes. And so we should start talking about these characters. So you mentioned who showed up for you first on the page, and then you got this unwieldy draft. And how did you know what to do next? So who is going to tell the story, and how were you going to, you know, reveal this world to audiences that wouldn't be familiar to with it?
Yeah, so speaking of the draft from the novel writing project, yeah, it originally started, just to give a sense of the evolution of it, so it started, if I remember right, it was about 330 pages and about 120,000 words. And then the finished novel. The finished novel is about 60,000 words and about 200 pages, so it was a lot of cutting. Or also, for people who maybe don't have a sense of that, The Great Gatsby is about 56,000 words, so it's a little bit longer than The Great Gatsby. So in novel terms, it's on the short side. Which, actually, when I first met with Peter at the beginning of the project, you know, he talks to each of the students individually, and I told him, you know, my goal was to write actually a kind of a Gatsby length novel. And then, you know, I came out of the project with the first draft with this huge mammoth thing, and I'm like, oh, what am I going to do? And so then I, you know, and then it was into the revision phase. So that first draft, as you're talking about revealing the characters earlier, so it originally had 9 first-person narrators.
I remember
that.
So I
had my little Faulkner complex, I guess, trying to write my own version of As I Lay Dying, I guess.
I'm glad you didn't.
No, I didn't. Yeah, so that was some advice I got both from Peter and from another editor, who just, you know, suggested that I cut it down to, you know, to 1 or 2 narrators. And yeah, that gets into, and I think that was really great advice. And after I went through that process, I really understood why that was the case. It's really hard to write multiple distinctive voices, so mm-hmm. getting it to 2, I think, was good. Yeah, I felt that one of the things that was non-negotiable, though, in terms of this process, was I wanted the novel to be in first person. And the reason for that is I wanted as little or zero sort of authorial voice in it. I wanted the characters just, in a sense, to be speaking directly to the reader as much as possible, so that there'd be no intermediate party, so that the reader would have an experience as if they were, you know, sitting in a bar, someone listening to this, each of the two main narrators telling them the story and what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was one of your non-negotiables, but yeah. In the end, it turned out to be a really good choice because the novel is excellent. Mm-hmm. And folks, this is Paula Granquist on Art Zany Radio. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Where You Come From Is Gone by Christopher Johnston, and you can check out his website at christopherjohnstonbooks.com if you want to get some more information. Take a look at the cover image, mm-hmm. which is also, we'll talk about that story maybe a little mm-hmm. bit later too. And so you found a way to tell the story, and then the character, you know, like you said, was it 9 originally?
They're originally, yeah, 9 first-person narrators in the original first draft. Yeah.
One thing people don't always think about is how do you make decisions about letting go of those characters? Because when you first crafted it, you thought that they had a piece of the puzzle that needed to be revealed, and you wanted to, you know, to have mm-hmm. that in there. So I would love to hear from you how you made those choices, because all of them were memorable, interesting, fascinating, had their own piece of that mm-hmm. little world up there in northern Minnesota.
Yeah, it was really difficult to figure that out when I first faced that challenge, you know, when I came to the conclusion, it's like, okay, there's got to be, you know, 1 or 2 narrators at most, and then it's like, okay, who stays and who goes? So that was really difficult. But ultimately, I came to the conclusion that it would be the father and son. And because ultimately I felt the core of the story is about these two men, and actually three men, really, the kind of the family patriarch, who's not a narrator, but he's important in the, mm-hmm. in the story. So I felt that those two were the most important to include, so that they'd essentially play off each other, but it also really convey this idea of identity and legacy and how it evolved from one generation to the next and how it changed because of the circumstances that are both internal to this, the family in this novel, as well as the external forces that, that get applied to them.
Right.
Over which, you know, they really have no, little or no control.
So we should share an excerpt so listeners can get to hear your voice and to begin to tell the story of these characters. It takes place, as we mentioned, 1960s, northern Minnesota. It's a, I believe this isn't a real town.
It's not.
Okay.
No. I made it up. That's a discussion we can have if you like. But
sure.
Yeah, so it's based on a real place, in a sense, like Sinclair Lewis based Main Street on Sauk Center.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it Gopher Prairie. So there's kind of, or to flatter myself, F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, takes the west end of Long Island and calls it East Egg.
Yep.
And even though you can look on a map and kind of see it. So
yeah.
And employed the same kind of strategy.
Right. So what would you like to read with? We talked about a few, there's like several different selections
that
are possible.
I'll start from the beginning close to the beginning. And just to set it up. So this is our main character, Peter Brennan. It's his first day back. He's just come back from the army from, Cold War Germany in the end of summer in 1960. It's his first day back working with his father out on the family fishing boat. And so they've gone out onto the lake. They've started working, and here we go. Here's what happens. So, Pete, wake up. You've let the takeoff cable go slack. It's come off the pulleys. Dad glared at me. Get your head out of your ass. The dipper floated in the pound with a tangle of cable piled on the handle. My heart hammered and my shoulders tightened. I thought I'd shed those adolescent feelings of failure in the army. Instead, disappointing my father still brought a stab of shame. Moose brought the slack cable on board. I rethreaded the cable through the winch pulley on top of the pilot house. On deck, I reattached the cable to the power takeoff. Ready? Moose nodded. Jim lowered the dipper into the pound and gave the thumbs up. I engaged the power takeoff, and that was it. The cable looped up to my left knee, tightened and sawed through my leg. Searing pain spread upward from my knee. I collapsed backward onto the fish-covered deck. A bloody loop of cable flew up. Jim appeared from around the fish boxes. Arthur, hold him down. After that, I remember fragments. Rolling over face down into the thrashing fish on the deck. Jim and Dad yelling. My belt snapping when it got pulled from my pants. Moose's eyes wide and glazed, a frightening tension in my forehead. The buzz of Swede's airplane. I'm going to pass out. It took full concentration to say each word. Bullshit, Jim's face hovered over mine. Stay with me. You're doing great. I heard guys in the Pacific make more noise over less. His voice started to sound slow and stretched. Just look at my face. I need a drink. My teeth slammed together. Jim pried open my mouth and Dad splashed in whiskey from his flask. Slant you, son. You're going to make it, goddammit. A warm sensation spread from my throat to my chest. The boat's engine roared to life. Jim tightened my belt around my thigh. Cold spray came over the gunwale and the wind blew it dry on my face. Hundreds of dying fish writhed against my arms, twisting as they gasped for life. I became one of them, twisting, nearly dead, hoping to be swept over the side to water and salvation. Jim slapped the side of my face. Pete, drink this. He pushed my jaw apart with his fingers. Lukewarm coffee dribbled down my throat. The engine whine shifted lower. Almost there, almost there. I spotted the Buffalo Point dock pilings. Jim hooked his arms under my shoulders. Moose, get your arms under his behind. They lifted me onto the dock. Another bolt of pain shot from my knee up into my thigh. Overhead, I saw the blue and yellow wing of Swede's plane rocking with the waves. Two middle-aged men looked down at me through the plane's side windows, a perfect outdoor catalog photo. Swede strapped me down in the back, next to the mailbag, a float cushion under my head. The plane rose, twisted, and dropped over and over again. Radio chatter and Swede's voice blended with the drone of the engine. I desperately wanted some water. I tried to count backward to stay conscious, only to find I'd drifted off each time my head bounced on the cushion and jolted me awake. They rolled me through the emergency entrance at the back of the Warland Hospital. A green-eyed nurse leaned over the gurney. "You're going to be okay. We'll take care of you." The gurney slammed through the emergency room doors, and I blacked out.
Ooh, that is such a good scene. And I know how hard you worked on trying to figure out when to put that in the story, yeah. How the story gets told. And it's just, it's gripping, right? It's
thank you.
Just a phenomenal opening to a story, because now we know he's in danger. I don't know if we'll tell him what's next.
Right.
What you've done such a great job in this novel is the managing the details of, you know, the fishing boat or the mink farm and, you know, all the different equipment. And, you know, I've never been on a commercial fishing boat. I've been, you know, in little tiny boats casting off and doing, you know, tiny lake fishing. But you never, as a reader, you never get mixed up, but you're so authentic in that. So it's that combination that makes for a really good read.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, commercial fishing, I mean, is, if I'm not mistaken, it's either the most dangerous or one of the most dangerous occupations there is. I think if you look at OSHA data, like it has the most fatalities and so on, because you're walking around on a deck where there's just all hazards of every kind. I mean, the surface is slippery. There's, you know, fish, you know, skidding around usually on a metal or a wooden deck. It's really slippery. There's all kinds of cables and equipment and stuff around. So there's just an infinite number of ways to get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, and the hurt yourself. Waves and the
right, and you have to remember it's all moving. You know, it's all going up and down and twisting and everything. So you're on this slippery surface, fish all over the place.
That was my favorite line from that section when he was laying on, and all the fish were, you know, flopping around and, you know, their last dying breath. That was really, really wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
And you do this so well, and it's this story of, you know, it's a masculine work world in this story, on both those mm-hmm. places. Not that it's not a family business, mm-hmm. but it's definitely a family business. And so the drama comes from both of those places, the danger of being in those working environments and then the relationships between all of the different characters in the family. And it's kind of I thought what was really interesting was just the interior world and the quiet world of these men in this family, and the women are there too, but they have just intentionally just a supportive role in the business. That's so you kind of played with those dynamics a bit.
I did. That's interesting that you bring that up. Yeah, in the first, I'll call it the first or initial more expansive drafts, we get more of these men's wives and partners and more of their interiority and detail, and I felt that was something ultimately that I thought it was really added depth and was significant to the story, but at the same time it was outside the main line or the main plot. So essentially what I did as we'd say, move some of it off stage so that you mm-hmm. hear about it and you learn about it, but you don't get sort of scene chapter and scenes, you know, with it.
But there are, I liked that it was just this working world, right? These you know, and they had jobs and they had things to do that you know, a world I wouldn't have ever entered. And you really portray that in a way, not just the work, but then alongside of that you've got all the complications of family that are playing out, and the relationships between the brothers and the one sister and the parents and the, you know, all the people on the boat. And that I think you did a really good, there's not a lot of books out there that really get into that world. So that's, I think, something really interesting.
Well, that was really another, you know, I mentioned the non-negotiable of having the book in the first person. Another sort of non-negotiable or really important point in my writing the novel was that I feel like in a lot of contemporary fiction, people don't work. the plot or the action involves people who are either, you know, extraordinarily wealthy or some other circumstance where you don't really get a view into their working lives or whatever their occupation is. And the reality is that's where most people spend the vast majority of their time. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about it, the typical work year for my management consulting days, is about 2,100 hours, over the course of a year. That's a lot of time.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's, for most people, it's 60 to 80% of their waking hours. And so I feel like that's not something that should be ignored in fiction. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that really needs to be addressed. But I think modern fiction really just does not, it bypasses it and makes it easy. And I think one of the reasons is our culture, American culture, despite its, in a sense, it's kind of a contradiction. At the same time, we're a culture that's obsessed with money and finance and wealth, but at the same time, it's something we don't talk about. I mean, we hesitate to talk about it more than sex.
Yeah. And so that I was pleased to be able to read a book that encompassed that. And I will say the other thing that's interesting is sort of because it's, there's a seasonality to each of these businesses, that becomes a part of the story too. And I think one of the most fascinating things is that it just so happens Thanksgiving is always the time where, how do we delicately say it?
Pelting.
Okay, let's
That's kind of the term, yeah, is pelting.
And so we do have to, as readers, go into that world. And that was uncomfortable for, but I think you, again, did really a brilliant job of just showing the work that needed to be done. And how they were able to sort of process that, that was their livelihood, right?
Yes.
And the fishing too was just to feed the mink,
right?
And yeah, so it's all linked.
Oh yeah, they were both linked. So yeah, the way this was not, I don't know if I'll say it was common, but we'll say it was a standard business model in that up in that region up around Lake of the Woods. It was not unusual for people who had mink farms to have a commercial fishing operation that supported it, because it feeding mink fish enhanced the quality of the fur, but also, if you're able to essentially provide the bulk of your own feed supply, of course, you're not shipping feed from, literally hundreds of miles away. Because again, for some of the listeners that may not know exactly, I mean, Lake of the Woods is up on the border with Canada. It's literally it's about 200 miles from Winnipeg, and it's almost 400 miles from the Twin Cities. So it's not by anything. So it's not easy to ship, food supplies, anything. So it's very remote.
Mm-hmm. And so writing that, how did that feel to write about the pelting season and the process of having, try to give people a sense of the scope of the number of mink.
Right. So it's the process of, just to start, it's the process of turning, a live animal, a mink, into a pelt or a fur like you'd see on a coat, on a mink coat. And so, yeah, obviously it's in the sense of the scale. I mean, typically most of the mink farms would probably have anywhere from 10 to 30,000 animals.
Mm.
And usually they would raise kits in the spring, which are the little ones, and then they would do pelting, which is where they separate their fur from their body, kill them and separate their fur from their body, which, as you can imagine, is a rough process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's portrayed pretty fully in the novel, and the people doing it. So, and I think, again, it's one of these processes that, I wanted to put forward so that readers could really see how difficult and challenging and everything that this kind of work is. So you get a sense, again, I wanted to portray people's occupation and what it really involves, not only the difficulty of the labor, but also, the emotional impact it has on mm-hmm. on these people, and kind of the physical and emotional scars it leaves on them, and how it affects their lives outside of their occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that was really, really important. and also portraying kind of the difficult conditions under which it all occurs. Again, we were talking about the fishing boat. Pelting mink is also up there at that time of the year. It's you know, usually really cold. Winter sets in early up there, so it'll be near zero. So there's people, you know, walking around in really cold weather doing this process of killing mink and bringing them in and bringing them into a building and, you know, doing the pelting process itself. And yeah, so it's strenuous work under difficult conditions, and it's the same thing. There's all kinds of different equipment and all kinds of different ways to injure yourself. And
right. Yeah. So everything that they did, there was danger in that. And so it's not just about the business. This is a family business. So it's a lot of the story is the arc of the characters in this business. What I find interesting is that not one of them really wanted to be like that. Business wasn't the chosen. It was just, this is what we did. And so then it was the way that they survived, right? And the way that they made their living. And so talk about kind of developing those character relationships and how, you know, you do a really good job of showing that generational, the stress of
having that
family business. Yeah.
Right. The patriarch of the family, Arthur, just to give the audience a sense of background. So there's Arthur, who's kind of the founder of the business. And then his son, Pete, who we just heard the scene from, who's on the boat and loses his leg from a cable taking his leg off. And then, and then he has a son later on. He has a son named Jay. So Arthur comes back, you know, he's an educated man, which is unusual in this small community. He meets a friend of his, Jim, who's on the boat, who's a Native American, who's an Ojibwe, and he learns how to snare mink, and that's how he starts this mink business. And, you know, he saves enough money to go to college, and he goes to college, you know, in the late 20s and gets a degree in mechanical engineering. But he comes back when he finishes college, it's at the worst of the Depression, so he has no options. And so he decides to go back and try to make this, you know, the mink farming and fishing business, you know, his way of life, even though he didn't really want to do that. You know, he wanted to go be a mechanical engineer and design airplanes and, you know, do that. So external circumstances kind of force him into this lifestyle. And then his son, you know, Pete, grows up amongst that, and he comes to love it, even though his dad really doesn't. Mm-hmm. And so there's this dynamic, you know, of the father who sees it as practical and the son who really becomes part of his identity, and it's the only thing he wants.
He wants the fishing.
He wants the fish. He loves being outside. He loves being on the lake. He likes the whole lifestyle. And so, yeah, so there's that tension between his father and son. And in that first chapter, Pete talks about, you know, his father's expectations and how they have a clash of expectations and all of that. So there's that tension there. And then there's a similar dynamic, which I won't necessarily go into at this point, between Pete and his son Jay as well, about the lifestyle and living up there and continuing the business and how to continue it and all that.
And then there's the tension too of so there's another brother who comes back from the military and kind of just ends up there because that's basically, you know, Wayne is his name, and he's kind of doesn't have another choice, just like his dad, right?
Right. So what he does, yeah. So his situation is, Pete's brother Wayne he goes to college, you know, which his father really emphasizes, and he's a hockey player, and he goes He plays, he's not giving any spoilers away. He plays for the Gophers, but he gets badly injured while he's playing hockey, and he's not able to really play anymore. And he gets depressed because he can't play hockey anymore and doesn't finish college and ends up drafted and goes to Alaska and comes back. And when he comes back, he doesn't really know what to do with himself. And so Arthur, the patriarch, basically gives him the job of running the mink farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, kind of not sure how to cope with that or what to do, and just sort of drifts. And yeah, I won't give more plot away, but he starts to drift and yes. things happen to him.
And so there's his story, and then you've got another brother who does go out east for college and then lives that life maybe that they all thought they wanted.
So there's three brothers, just to really put it all in context. So Arthur, the patriarch of the family, and then he has three sons and a daughter. Pete, who we've heard about, and then Wayne, who we just talked about, and then he has his oldest son named Lance, who actually does kind of fulfill his father's expectations almost too well.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he does fulfill them too well and leaves and becomes a very successful business executive. And that creates sort of a whole, I'll call it a class dynamic. Because he becomes very successful and very well off, lives in the Twin Cities and has all the accoutrements of business success. And so it creates this tension where, yeah, they're very, in a sense, very proud of him, but it also creates this kind of resentment.
Mm-hmm. And that is the heart of the story yeah. is how do families deal with that? How do we, you know, make sense of that? And then there's other pressures of just the challenges, the politics. We won't get into necessarily, but what's happening to the business, the community, and what, you know, the competition, if you will, of other successful businesses.
Right.
And just that whole nature of everybody's just trying to survive. And it's really just, like, it's a very impactful story, there's just so many moments in it where you can, you know, you just feel for this family. You get connected to the family. Mm. So when did you know that okay, this is the version, I've worked at it, because I know you worked for years to rearrange and find out those narrators' voices and whose story was it going to be, that you wanted to put it out in the world and you wanted to, you know, connect with agents and publishers mm-hmm. and editors and all of that. How did you know when that was ready?
I worked with a freelance editor I worked with who had actually been a acquiring editor at Penguin Random House, you know, one of the big New York publishers. So, I worked with her over the course of probably 2 years or a year and a half of going back and forth and refining it and so on, which was really an enormous help.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I'd been through that process, I guess I'll say, made changes, sent them to her, I'd get feedback, and then ultimately there was a point where, you know, we just kind of really mutually agreed. It's like, yeah, I think it's done. I think it's, you know, it's really the final version after, you know, cutting down the shortening it, reducing the number of narrators, putting some plot lines, some things off stage, and, you know, so on.
And I think one thing people don't realize is, like, every word is like, you have to decide. It's not just a, you know, take a few, you know, adverbs out, right?
Right.
You're questioning, what is this work doing work in the story? How is this advancing? What's going on? I mean, it's arduous.
It is. Yeah. It's really a process. I mean, at least for me, it's really going making multiple passes, and or as George Saunders would say, I never talk about writing without talking about George Saunders, is you go through
true.
and you interrogate every sentence and every word and every paragraph to is it carrying its weight? Is it conveying something that's important to the story, something that's important to the characters? So each, you're really testing each thing. Or I don't know if Hemingway really said this, but I suspect, say, like, if you pull, it's almost like a house of cards in a sense. Like, if you pulled one word out or if you pulled one sentence out, the whole thing had come apart.
That's
what I was trying for in going through it over and over and over again, is making sure that there's nothing there that's non-essential. And that's also part of the, in a sense, in character with the two narrators, because they're these sort of reticent northern Minnesota men, you know, who are not, I won't say they're not inarticulate, to be double negative, but they are not inarticulate, but they are also not emotive necessarily. And so that's, I really wanted to capture that and capture that laconic nature.
Mm-hmm.
in the writing and everything. And I felt that one of the best ways to achieve that is to really make it, I won't say quite spare, say spare necessarily, but make it so that there's nothing extraneous.
Yes.
You know, so that it's very minimalist and not overly, you know, overly flowery language or anything like that.
You've captured that, and that I think that's what makes it such a fascinating novel. Folks, if you're tuning in, this is Paula Grandquist on Art Zany Radio. Where You Come From Is Gone, the book by Christopher Johnston, the novel, is what we're talking about today. And it's just, I'm so excited that this managed to get published and that this is out into the world now. And we could do a whole show, probably hours, maybe a whole series on publishing.
Yes, publishing.
And we've had lots of long conversations about that. Yeah. And but I think a lot of people who write don't realize that that's like another job. You get another job when you enter that world.
Yeah, so I would quite put it this way, but it's almost like the easy part's writing the novel.
That's and obviously we know how hard a bit that of an is. Extreme,
but the whole going through the process of getting published is really where, in a sense, you have to have your wits about you and have some persistence and fortitude, because if you're not comfortable with rejection, it's going to be really difficult. Mm. I actually wrote a post on Substack about this, about my journey, I'll call it.
To use the
cliche. So in summary, so I did this Substack post, and I list these bullet points of all these other novels and how many rejections they got. And all I'll say is there's some really, you know, iconic novels that got rejected many times. And so I'm not necessarily putting myself in the category of iconic, but this novel got rejected. If I remember right, it was about 120 times, a little over 120 times by various agents and editors. And, you know, of course it's really disappointing. I went through a pretty thorough process of vetting, you know, potential editors and agents and publishers and so on, you know, so I wasn't like submitting to just anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really was going, okay, I think this would be a good fit for my book and all of that. And so, yeah, it was really it's disappointing each time. And the worst part about it, in a sense, is that the way a lot of agents and editors now are getting so many submissions that they don't even respond. I mean, their policy is, you know, if you don't hear back from us, you know, like in 4 weeks or 8 weeks, then, you know, we're not interested. So it's just this kind of void.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating. But right, you have managed to find a way to bring it out into the world. And you are, you know, in the process, it's just early days of having this released. And so what's the response been? I'm curious. What are you finding now that you can hold this in your hand? And
well, it's an amazing feeling. And one of the reasons is that, I guess, from my cycling experience, I mean, persistence is a necessary quality in bike racing too, you know, because if you're facing, you know, a 200 kilometers or 120 mile road race, you know, you've got to have this idea that, okay, it's, you know, I'm going to be out on the road for 5 hours and, you know, have that sense of persistence in the training and everything.
Or 12 hours if it were something.
Right. And that came in. Yeah.
That's an amazing distance to bike race.
So that came in, that psychology, that mentality really came in handy for this process. So it's like, okay, I know this is going to be difficult. I know there's parts of it that are going to hurt. There's going to be setbacks. And I just have to accept that. So, yeah, that was really a challenge, you know, a challenge. So I can't remember.
Just the reception, your family.
Oh, the reception, yeah.
How do they feel that some of their business is in here? Have you been up to your hometown to promote the book
yet? So there's been a wide range of response. Frankly, there's some people who just like, got to, you know, into chapter two or three and like couldn't go any further. There's other people who read it and
that's
it.
Not because of the writing, it's because of the subject
well,
matter.
Yes, yeah, subject matter. So I think it in one of the, again, I'm somewhat of a Hemingway fan, not of the, in a sense, not of the man, but of the writing.
Yes.
And there's a in one of his lesser novels, I can't remember, it's Into the Woods and Through the Trees or something like that. Very lesser known novel from the early 50s, late in his career. And he has there's a paragraph at the beginning where he says, as is prone these days, people are, he puts it in some kind of funny way, but people are prone to looking for the real people and the real places and the real situations and fictions and trying to, you know, connect the dots and all this stuff. So I know there are some readers, you know, who are engaged in doing that. And I think I understand that propensity, but it's also, I think, a distraction.
They're turning it into a game, right? Can I find myself? Can I find my family?
can I find this, you know, how much, you know, what's what? And I think, I think that's a distraction. I mean, I understand it. You know, I understand it. I mean, people did that, you know, like the classic cases, like The Sun Also Rises and Hemingway's book, you know, because he basically wrote about this group of real people that, you know, he went down to Pamplona from Paris with and partied with and gave them fictional names. And basically the rest was pretty real. So, you know, scholars to this day are still, you know, playing the game of figuring out, you know, who is who and all this stuff. So, you know, I know that that exists, but overall, I guess I hope that people would, I mean, I understand that propensity, but I also hope that it's not, in most cases, not too much of a distraction, that people can focus on the overall arc of the story and what happened and understand the experience of what this family went through and that it's not only, and the overall arc, I would say, is not unique to this place or this town. I think it's common all over the country in different towns. It's just different industries, different businesses, different situations. I mean, so yeah, this family happens to be in fishing and mink farming, which is somewhat unique, which I thought was, you know, would make it more compelling. But it happens, you know, to people who are, you know, farming corn and soybeans and raising cattle and so on. A similar kind of dynamic plays out in across rural America, all over the all over the United States. So I think it's a story that's relevant not only to, you know, just this particular place in these particular industries, but also to the country as a whole.
I would say so too. It's eye-opening, right? To look at the value of hard work and, you know, if the sense of family and legacy, and, you know, we're all just trying to make our way through and trying to do the best we can. And sometimes it goes great and sometimes there's trouble. And, you know, how do we cope with those moments? And so it's definitely in here. I read that you had a launch party just a couple weeks ago.
I did.
And I love that I don't know this place, but Brother Justice Whiskey Distillery sounds like an incredible place.
It's an incredible place. It's a whiskey distillery in the Twin Cities up in Northeast. For those familiar with Minneapolis, it's a really nice venue. It's in an old kind of a warehouse and has a fireplace and a little library at one end and kind of a long rectangular hall. And so, yeah, it ended up being on March 4th, and in the we ended up having a snowstorm or blizzard, but still I had a great turnout. It was really fun. I had a great conversation with Peter Guy, who, you know, led the novel writing project and was an integral part of this process. So yeah, Brother Justice was a great venue. And as you may have picked up, there's in the scene I read, the family drinks whiskey at different points of the novel. That's kind of a motif that's through it when different things happen. And so I thought it was really appropriate to have it at a whiskey distillery because it plays such a role throughout
the
novel.
The toast, because I want to hear from you the correct pronunciation of the Gaelic word.
Oh, so slancha is the
slancha
is what it is, and it's a Gaelic word for health. And it's used, like, you know, in other cultures, like you'll hear, you know, Italians and say salute or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a word that's used at a celebration for with family and friends and so on, for to good health.
So that comes up. And so now say it one more time for us.
Sláinte.
Sláinte. That is not how I was saying it, so I'm glad you said it to me so I know how to say it. And let's just quickly talk about the cover art, because I think that's something most authors don't get a chance to be a part of. And this is real, based on a real photograph, it which is a really interesting thing that you got to be able to have that as your book cover.
It is. Yeah, it is based on a real, is a painting based on a real, on a photograph of my relatives out fishing out on Lake of the Woods and on their fishing boat. And the boat's kind of described in its process is in the book. But yes. And then the other reason I want it, and this is something I really worked with the publisher on, was it wasn't part of, I don't remember if it was part of that section I read, but Mary, the sister of these main characters in the novel, is a painter. And so, and one of the things she does is she paints people working. And so, in a, even though it's not ever explicitly stated or anything, and I guess the idea was is that you, that I wanted the cover to kind of be a paint, you know, a painting like she would have done.
Yeah, and it's a really very captivating image that should draw people in. The book, again, is Where You Come From Is Gone, a novel by Christopher Johnston. And I'm so excited to be able to bring this story to all of our listeners, and I hope that they will. You can find it at local bookstores.
It's everywhere. You can buy it at local bookstores. You can get it at bookshop.org. You know, if you want to buy online through your local bookstore, you can get it. And then, of course, you can get it at the Behemoths. You can get it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. And then also, I will be at the Rosemont Writers Festival tomorrow. So when I come out, I'll be there to sign books.
Oh, I didn't realize that was tomorrow already. Yeah. So the date on that is March 15th, 2025.
Yep. So I'll be there all day tomorrow.
That is a fun festival. I've been there many times. A lot of great, great folks there. Yeah. So that's just right up the road. I'm so thrilled for you, and I want to thank you so much for coming into Art Zany Radio to share this story, and I hope people pick up a copy of the book. It is a good read. It's a good read for everyone to understand the value of work and the difficulties of making life work you know, wherever you are.
Thanks, Paula. It's great to be here in the studio with you.
Yes. Folks, this is Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. I thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to come back after a quick closing announcements and tell you about some events happening in our community that I want you to know about. So I'll be right back on Art Zany Radio.
You've been listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zany is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372.
This is Paula Granquist. We're back, and I've got some announcements to make about some events. One I want to talk to you about is the Culture Crew Story Hour event. That's Thursday, the 20th of March, 2025 at 7 p.m. That's at the Armory Square Event Center. Starts in the Lowdown. I think that's where the... No, I'm sorry. I've got it right backwards. It starts at 6 in the Tiki Bar for happy hour and then moves to the Lowdown for the Story Hour, and it's a partnership with the Library, the Arts Guild, and the History Center. It's where story storytellers will share true story, and it's we'll call it moth-like, because this is we did have some folks from that organization come and help us. This started a year ago, and one of the things I wanted to talk to Christopher about is because he's done a couple of moth events. What advice do you have for the folks who might be presenting to tell their stories? Because you don't get to use notes. It's a true story, and it has to be really short. I think our stories are like 4 to 5 minutes long.
Yes, that's how the loft is, or I'm sorry, the moth is when I did it, it was true stories told live without notes. That was kind of the tagline. And then when you do the main stage, they're a little longer. They're about 10 minutes. Mm. But the slams, you know, which are every monthly in the Twin Cities, for those who don't do that, are 5 minutes. So yeah, I did the main stage, and when I did the main stage, you know, that I worked with, they had producers come out from New York, the main organization, and do it. Advice for people who are going to do it, write yourself a script, work, you know, practice, and then, but don't feel like you have to, when you're performing, don't feel like you've got to, you know, stick to it or memorize it, you know, just get to the point where you've mastered it, I would say. So you can just tell it in a very informal way. And so that also you can be engaged with the audience. Because it's really important that you can, you know, kind of have a sense or a feel for how the audience is receiving it and sort of adjust based on that. So
be in the moment.
Be in the moment.
And so yeah. I hope people will come and listen to that again Thursday the 20th at 6 p.m. Happy Hour starts. Stories at 7. There's another event happening that I want to bring to your attention. This is the one I couldn't find my notes for last week. Dan Schwinard is going to be here with Thomasina Petrus at the Singer's Voice event at the Northfield Arts Guild. That's Sunday the 16th at 7 p.m. at the Arts Guild Theater. You can get tickets now through northfieldartsguild.org. Thomasina is just, I've listened to a few of her songs. They are just incredible. I've been to the other events. It's an evening of intimate song and stories. It's just a great opportunity to see an artist in a new way. So I hope you'll do that. I've also got in news from Randy Ferguson, and he has at the Northfield Depot on Saturday, March 15th at 7 p.m., a program on the history and evolution of the guitar, from the stately court music of Renaissance Europe to the exciting syncopated dance rhythms of Spanish flamenco. He's got all his guitars. It's a beautiful space for acoustics, and so he's very excited to be able to perform, so I hope you will join him for that. There's always a lot happening in our town, so I hope you'll always remember to go out there and enjoy your imagination, and of course, find some time for some Art Zany.
Enjoy weekends with Wendy, Saturday and Sunday mornings here on The One.